Letter. Dear James, by the time you read this, it will all be finished. You will forgive me for not having spoken to you earlier, for not taking you into my confidence, but I am sure that in time you will understand. There are some notes which I have written and which you will find in my desk. They relate to my condition and to the decision that I have made. I want it to be understood that the doctor's diagnosis is clear, and for me, there can be no possibility of reprieve. I have no fear of death. I would like to think that my name will be remembered. What are you doing, Susan? That was as far as I got when I heard the voice coming from the door and looked up to see Charles Clover standing there. So there had been someone on the stairs. He was wearing corduroy trousers and a baggy jersey with a coat hanging loosely open. He looked tired. I found the missing chapters, I said. Yes, I can see that. There was a long silence. It was only 6:30, but it felt later. There was no sound of any traffic outside. Why are you here? I asked. I'm taking a few days off. I came to get some things. How's Laura? She had a little boy. They're going to call him George. That's a nice name. I thought so. He moved into the room and sat down in one of the armchairs. I was standing behind his desk, so it was as if our positions had been reversed. I can explain to you why I hid the pages, Charles said. I knew that he had already started thinking up an explanation and that whatever he said, it wouldn't be true. There's no need to, I said. I already know everything. Really? I know you killed Alan Conway, and I know why. Why don't you sit down? He waved a hand towards the cabinet where he kept his drinks. Would you like a glass of something? Thank you. I went over and poured 2 glasses of whiskey. I was glad that Charles had made it easier for me. The two of us had known each other for a very long time, and I was determined that we were going to be civilized. I still wasn't sure what would happen next. I assumed that Charles would telephone Detective Superintendent Locke and turn himself in. I gave him the drink and sat down opposite. I think the tradition is that you tell me what happened, Charles said, although we can always do it the other way round, if you prefer. Aren't you going to deny it? I can see it would be completely pointless. You found the pages. You could have hidden them more carefully, Charles. I didn't think you'd look. I must say, I was very surprised to find you in my office. I'm surprised to see you, too. He raised his glass in an ironic toast. He was my boss, my mentor, a grandfather, the godfather. I couldn't believe we were having this conversation. Nonetheless, I began, not quite at the beginning as I would have liked, but I was finally wearing the hat of the detective, not the editor. Alan Conway hated Atticus Punt, I said. He thought of himself as a great writer, a Salman Rushdie, a David Mitchell, someone people would take seriously, when all he was doing was churning out potboilers, murder mysteries, which were making him a fortune, but which he himself despised. The book that he showed you, The Slide, that was what he really wanted to write. It was dreadful. I know. Charles looked surprised, so I told him. I found it in his office, and I read it. I agree with you. It was derivative and it was rubbish. But it was about something. It was his view of society, how the old values of the literary classes had rotted away, and how without them, the rest of the country was slipping into some sort of moral and cultural abyss. It was his big statement. And he just couldn't see that it would never be published. And it would never be read because it was no good. He believed that was what he was born to write. And he blamed Atticus Punt for getting in the way and spoiling everything for him. Did you know that it was Melissa Conway who first suggested he should write a detective novel? No, she never told me that. It's one of the reasons why he divorced her. Those books made him a fortune. He didn't care. He had £1 million, then he had £10 million. He could have had £100 million, but he didn't have what he wanted, which was respect. the imprimatur of the great writer. And as mad as it sounds, he wasn't the only successful writer who felt that way. Look at Ian Fleming and Conan Doyle, even A.A. Milne. Milne disliked Winnie the Pooh because he was so successful. But I think the big difference is that Alan hated Punt from the very start. He never wanted to write any of the novels, and when he became famous, he couldn't wait to get rid of him. Are you saying I killed him because he wouldn't write any more? No, Charles. I dug into my handbag and took out a packet of cigarettes. To hell with office regulations. We were talking murder here. We'll get to why you killed him in a minute. But first of all, I'm going to tell you what happened, and also how you gave yourself away. Why don't we start with that, Susan? I'd be interested to know. How you gave yourself away? The funny thing is, I remember the moment exactly. It was like an alarm bell went off in my head, but I couldn't make the connection. I suppose it was because I simply couldn't imagine you as a killer. I kept thinking you were the last person to want Alan dead. Go on. Well, when I was in your office, the day we heard that Alan had committed suicide, you made a point of telling me that you hadn't been to Framlingham for 6 months, not since March or April. It was an understandable lie. You were trying to distance yourself from the scene of the crime. But the trouble is, when we drove up to the funeral together, you warned me to take a different route, to avoid the roadworks at Earl Soham. They'd only just started. Mark Redman told me that. And the only way you could have known about them is if you'd been up more recently. You must have driven through Earl Soham on the Sunday morning when you killed Alan. Charles considered what I had said and smiled half ruefully. You know, that's exactly the sort of thing Alan would have put in one of his books. I thought so too. I'll have a little more whiskey, if you don't mind. I poured some for him, and a little more for myself. I needed to keep a clear head, but the Glenmorangie went very well with the cigarette. Alan didn't give you the manuscript of Magpie Murders at the Ivy Club, I said. It actually came here in the post, on Tuesday, the 25th of August. Jemima opened the envelope and saw it. You must have read it the same day. I finished it on Wednesday. You had dinner with Alan on Thursday evening. He was already in London because he had an afternoon appointment with his doctor, Sheila Bennett. Her initials were in his diary. I wonder if that was when she told him the bad news, that his cancer was terminal. I can't imagine what must have been going through his head when he sat down with you. But of course it was a horrible evening for both of you. After dinner, Alan went back to his London flat, and the following day he wrote you a letter, apologizing for his bad behavior. It was dated 28th of August, which was the Friday. My guess is that he dropped it in by hand. I'll come back to that letter in a minute, but I want to get all my ducks in a row. Timelines, Susan. They always were your strong suit. You faked that business with the spilled coffee and fired Jemima on Friday morning. She was completely innocent, but you were already planning to kill Alan. You were going to make it look like suicide, but it would only work if you hadn't read Magpie Murders. Jemima had actually handed you the novel a few days earlier. She'd probably seen Alan's letter too. You knew I was coming back from Dublin on Friday afternoon, and it was absolutely essential that she and I shouldn't meet. As far as I was concerned, you would be at home over the weekend reading Magpie Murders, the same as me. It was your alibi. But what mattered just as much was that you should have no reason to kill Alan. You still haven't told me the reason. I will. I unscrewed a bottle of ink on Charles's desk and used the lid as an ashtray. I could feel the whiskey warming my stomach, encouraging me to continue. Alan drove back to Framlingham on either Friday evening or Saturday morning. You must have known that he'd broken up with James, and you guessed that he would be alone in the house. You drove up on Sunday morning. But when you arrived, you saw that there was someone with him, up on the roof. That was John White, his neighbor. You parked your car behind a bush where it wouldn't be seen. I noticed the tire tracks when I was there, and watched what happened. The two men had an altercation, which turned into a scuffle and you took a photograph of the two of them, just in case it might be useful. And it was, wasn't it, Charles? When I told you that I believed Alan had been murdered, you sent it to me, to put me on the wrong track. But it wasn't White who killed him. He left, and you watched him take the shortcut back to his house through the trees. That was when you made your move. You went into the house. Presumably, Alan thought you had come to continue the conversation that had begun at the Ivy Club. He invited you to join him for breakfast on the tower, or maybe you talked your way up there. How you got up there doesn't really matter. The point is that when you got the opportunity, when his back was to you, you pushed him off. That was only part of it. After you'd killed him, you went into Alan's study, because you'd read Magpie Murders, and you knew exactly what you were looking for. It was a gift, a suicide letter written in Alan's own hand. We both know that Alan always wrote the first draft by hand. You had the letter that Alan had hand-delivered on Friday morning, but there was a second letter in the book, and you realized you could use it. I really have to kick myself, because I've been an editor for more than 20 years, and this must be the only crime ever committed that an editor was born to solve. I knew there was something strange about Alan's suicide letter, but I didn't see what it was. I know now. Alan wrote pages 1 and 2 on the Friday morning, but page 3, the actual page that signals his intention to kill himself, has been taken from the book. It's no longer Alan's voice. There's no slang, no swearing. It's formal, slightly stilted, as if it's been written by someone for whom English is a second language. For me, there can be no possibility of a reprieve. It is my hope that you will be able to complete the work of my book. It's not a letter from Alan to you. It's a letter from Punt to James Fraser, and the book he refers to is not Magpie Murders. It's The Landscape of Criminal Investigation. You were incredibly lucky. I don't know exactly what Alan wrote to you, but the new page, which eventually became page 3, fitted in perfectly. You had to cut a little bit off the top, though. There's one line missing, the line that reads, "Dear James." I could have worked that out if I'd measured the pages, but I'm afraid that was something I missed, and there was something else. To complete the illusion that all 4 pages belong to the same single letter, you added numbers in the right top corner. But if I looked more closely, I'd have seen that the numbers are darker than the letters. You used a different pen. Otherwise, it was perfect. For Alan's death to appear like suicide, you needed a suicide letter, and now you had one. It still had to be delivered. The letter that Alan had actually sent you, the one apologizing about the dinner which you had received the day before, had been hand-delivered. You needed it to appear as if it had been posted from Ipswich. The answer was simple. You found an old envelope. I suppose it was one that Alan had sent you at some other time, and put your manufactured suicide note in there. You assumed that no one would look too closely at the envelope. It was the letter that mattered. But as it happens, I did notice 2 things. The envelope was torn. I assume you'd deliberately ripped through the postmark to obliterate the date. But there was something much more striking. The letter was handwritten, but the envelope was typed. It exactly reflected something that had happened in Magpie Murders, and of course it stuck in my mind. So let's get to the heart of the matter. You'd used part of a letter written by Atticus Punt, and unfortunately, if your plan was going to work, nobody could read it. If anyone put 2 and 2 together, the entire suicide theory would collapse. So that was why the chapters had to disappear. I have to say, I was puzzled why you were so unenthusiastic when I suggested travelling up to Framlingham to find them. But now I know why you didn't want them to be found. You removed the handwritten pages. You took Alan's notebooks. You cleared the hard drive on his computer. It would mean losing the 9th book in the series, or postponing it until we could get someone else to finish it. But for you, it was a price well worth paying. Charles sighed a little and set down his glass, which was empty again. There was a strange, relaxed atmosphere in the room. The two of us could have been discussing the proof of a novel, as we had done so many times in the past. For some reason, I was sorry that Bella wasn't here. I don't know why. Perhaps it would have made everything that was unfolding feel a little more normal. "I had a feeling that you'd see through it all, Susan," he said. "You're very clever. I've always known that. However, the motive. You still haven't told me why I killed Alan." "It was because he was going to pull the plug on Atticus Punt. Isn't that right? It all goes back to that dinner at the Ivy Club. That was when he told you. He had a radio interview with Simon Mayo the following week, and it would give him the perfect opportunity to do it. The one thing that would give him a good laugh before he died. Something that mattered even more than seeing the final book in print. You lied to me when you said he wanted to cancel the interview. It was still in his diary, and the radio station didn't know he was going to drop out. I think he wanted to go ahead. I think he was desperate." "He was sick," Charles said. "In more ways than one," I agreed. "What I find extraordinary is that he had been planning this all along, from the very day that he invented Atticus Punt. What sort of writer builds a self-destruct mechanism into his own work and watches it tick away for 11 long years? But that's what Alan did. It was the reason why the last book had to be called Magpie Murders and nothing else. He had built an acronym into the 9 titles. The first letter spelled out 2 words.
An anagram."
"You knew?"
"Alan told me."
"An anagram. But an anagram of what? In the end, it didn't take me too long to work it out. It wasn't the titles. They're perfectly innocent. It wasn't the characters. They were named after birds. It wasn't the policemen. They were nicked out of Agatha Christie, or based on people he knew. James Fraser was named after an actor. That just leaves one character.
Atticus Punt.
It's an anagram of a stupid... Forgive me if I don't spell out that last word. You can work it out easily enough for yourself, but personally, I hate it. Swear words in books have always struck me as lazy and over-familiar. But the C word is more than that. It's used by sour, frustrated men, nearly always about women. It's a word full of misogyny, crudely offensive. And that's what it all came down to. That was what Alan Conway thought about the character that his ex-wife had got him to write. It was what summed up his feelings about the whole detective genre. He told you, didn't he? I went on. That's what happened at the Ivy Club. Alan told you he was going to share his little secret with the entire world when he went on the Simon Mayo show the following week.
Yes.
And that was why you had to kill him.
You're absolutely right, Susan.
Alan had drunk a fair bit, that very good wine I'd ordered, and he told me as we left the restaurant. He didn't care. He was going to die anyway, and he was determined to take Atticus with him. He was a devil. Do you know what would have happened if he had told people that? They would have hated him. There would have been no BBC television series. You can forget about that. We wouldn't have sold another book, not one. The entire franchise would have become valueless.
So you did it for the money?
That's putting it very bluntly. But I suppose it's true. Yes. I've spent 11 years building up this business, and I wasn't going to see it destroyed overnight by some ungrateful bastard who'd actually done very well out of us. I did it for my family and for my new grandson. You could say, I did it in part for you, although I know you won't thank me. I also did it for the millions of readers all over the world who had invested in Atticus, who'd enjoyed his stories and bought the books. I had absolutely no compunction whatsoever. My only regret is that you've managed to find out, which I suppose makes you my partner in crime.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I suppose it depends on what you intend to do. Have you told anyone else what you've told me?
No.
Then you might take the view that you don't need to. Alan is dead. He was going to die anyway. You've read the first page of his letter. He had, at best, 6 months. I shortened his life by that amount of time, and quite possibly saved him a great deal of suffering along the way.
He smiled. I won't pretend that was uppermost in my mind. I think I did the world a favor. We need our literary heroes. Life is dark and complicated, but they shine out. They're the beacons that we follow. We have to be pragmatic about this, Susan. You're going to be the CEO of this company. My offer was made in good faith, and it still stands. Without Atticus Punt, there will be no company. If you don't want to think of yourself, think of everyone else in this building. Would you like to see them put out of their jobs? That's a little unfair, Charles. Cause and effect, my dear. That's all I'm saying. In a way, I'd been dreading this moment. It was all very well to unmask Charles Clover, but all along, I'd been wondering what I'd do next. Everything that he had just said had already occurred to me. The world was not exactly going to be a worse-off place without Alan Conway, his sister, his ex-wife, his son, Donald Lee, the vicar, Detective Superintendent Locke. They had all, to a greater or a lesser extent, been harmed by him. And it was certainly true that he had been about to play a very mean trick on the people who loved his books. He was going to die anyway. But it was that, my dear, that decided me. There was something quite repellent about the way he had addressed me. They were exactly the sort of words that Moriarty would have used, or Flombo, or Carl Peterson, or Arnold Zeck. And if it was true that detectives acted as moral beacons, why shouldn't their light guide me now? I'm sorry, Charles, I said. I don't disagree with what you say. I didn't like Alan, and what he did was horrible. But the fact is you killed him, and I can't let you get away with it. I'm sorry, but I wouldn't be able to live with myself.
You're going to turn me in?
No. I don't need to be involved, and I'm sure it'll be a lot easier for you if you call the police yourself. He smiled, very thinly.
You realize that they'll send me to prison. I'll get life. I'll never come out.
Yes, Charles. That's what happens when you commit murder.
You surprise me, Susan. We've known each other a very long time. I never thought you'd be so petty.
Is that what you think? I shrugged. Then there's nothing else to say. He glanced at his empty glass, then back at me.
How long can you give me? He asked. Would you allow me a week's grace? I'd like to spend some time with my family and with my new grandson. I'll need to find Bella a home, that sort of thing.
I can't give you a week, Charles. That would make me an accomplice. Maybe until the weekend?
All right. That's fair enough.
Charles got up and walked over to the bookshelf. His whole career was spread out in front of him. He had published many of those books himself. I also stood up. I had been sitting down for so long that I felt my knees creak. I really am sorry, Charles, I said. Part of me was still wondering if I'd made the right decision. I wanted to be out of the room.
No, it's all right.
Charles had his back to me. I completely understand. Good night, Charles.
Good night, Susan.
I turned and took a step towards the door. And right then, something hit me, incredibly hard on the back of the head. I saw an electric white flash, and it felt as if my whole body had been broken in half. The room tilted violently to one side, and I crashed down to the floor. Endgame. I was so shocked, so taken by surprise, that it actually took me a few moments to work out what had happened. It may be that I was also briefly unconscious. When I opened my eyes, Charles was standing over me with a look that I can only describe as apologetic. I was lying on the carpet, my head close to the open door. Something trickled round my neck, coming from under my ear, and with difficulty I reached up and touched it. When I moved my hand away, I saw that it was covered in blood. I had been hit extremely hard. Charles was holding something in his hand, but my eyes didn't seem to be working properly,
as if something had been disconnected. In the end, I managed to focus, and if I hadn't been frightened and in pain, I might almost have laughed. He was holding the Golden Dagger Award that Alan had won for Atticus Punt Investigates. If you've never seen one of these before, it's a miniature-sized dagger encased in a fairly substantial block of perspex, rectangular with sharp edges. Charles had used it to club me down. I tried to speak, but the words wouldn't come. Perhaps I was still dazed, or perhaps I simply didn't know what to say. Charles examined me, and I think I actually saw the moment when he came to his decision. The life went out of his eyes, and it suddenly occurred to me that murderers are the loneliest people on the planet. It's the curse of Cain, the fugitive and the vagabond driven out from the face of the earth. However he might try to justify it, Charles had parted company with the rest of humanity the moment he had pushed Alan off that tower. And the man who was standing over me now was no longer my friend or colleague. He was empty. He was going to kill me now, to silence me. Because when you have killed one person, you have entered a sort of existential realm, where to kill two more or to kill 20 will make no difference. I knew this, and I accepted it. Charles would never know peace. He would never play happily with his grandchild. He would never be able to shave without seeing the face of a murderer. I found a little solace in that, but I would be dead. There was nothing I could do to prevent it. I was terrified. He set the award down.
"Why did you have to be so bloody obstinate?" he asked, in a voice that wasn't quite his own. "I didn't want you to go looking for the missing chapters. I didn't care about the bloody book. All I was doing was protecting everything I'd worked for and my future. I tried to get you to back off. I tried to send you in the wrong direction, but you wouldn't listen. And now, what am I going to do? I still have to protect myself, Susan. I'm too old to go to prison. You didn't have to go to the police. You could have just walked away. You're so bloody stupid."
He wasn't exactly talking to me. It was more a stream of consciousness, a conversation that he was having with himself. For my part, I lay where I was, unmoving. There was a searing pain in my head, and I was furious with myself. He had asked me if I had told anyone else what I knew. I should have lied. At the very least, I could have pretended I was with him, that I was happy to be an accomplice to Alan's death. I could have said that and walked out of the office. Then I could have called the police. I had brought this on myself. "Charles," I croaked the single word. Something had happened to my eyesight. He was going in and out of focus. The blood was spreading around my neck. He had been looking around him and picked something up. It was the box of matches that I had used to light my cigarette. I only understood what he was doing when I saw the flare of the phosphorus. It looked huge. He seemed to disappear behind it.
"I'm sorry, Susan," he said.
He was going to set fire to the office. He was going to leave me to burn alive, getting rid of the only witness and, for that matter, the incriminating pages, which were still sitting on the desk where I had left them. I saw his hand move in an arc, and it was as if a fireball had streaked across the room, whooping down beside the bookshelves. In a modern office, it would have hit the carpet and gone out. But everything about Cloverleaf Books was antique. The building, the wood panelling, the carpets, the furnishings. The flames leapt up instantly, and I was so dazzled by the sight of them that I didn't even see him throw a second match, starting a second blaze on the other side of the room. This time, the fire rushing up the curtains and licking at the ceiling. The very air seemed to turn orange. I couldn't believe how quickly it had happened. It was as if I was inside a crematorium. Charles moved towards me, a huge dark figure that filled my vision. I thought he was going to step over me. I was lying in front of the door. But before he went, he lashed out one last time, and I screamed as his foot slammed into my chest.
I tasted blood in my mouth. There were tears flooding out of my eyes from the pain and the smoke. Then he was gone. The office burned gloriously. The building dated back to the 18th century, and it was a fire that was worthy of that time. I could feel it scorching my cheeks and hands, and I thought I must be alight myself. I might simply have lain there and died, but alarms had gone off throughout the building, and they jolted me awake. Somehow, I had to find the strength to get up and stagger out of there. There was an explosion of wood and glass as one of the windows disintegrated, and that helped me too. I felt a cold wind rush in. It revived me a little and prevented the smoke from asphyxiating me. I reached out and felt the side of the door, used it to pull myself up. I could barely see. The orange and red of the flames were burning themselves into my eyes. It hurt me to breathe. Charles had broken some of my ribs, and I wondered even then how he could have brought himself to behave so brutally, this man I had known for so long. Anger spurred me on, and somehow I found myself on my feet. But that didn't help me. I had actually been safer closer to the floor. Standing up, I was surrounded by smoke and toxic fumes. I was seconds away from passing out. The alarms were pounding in my ears. If there were fire engines on the way, I wouldn't be able to hear them. I could hardly see. I couldn't breathe. And then I screamed as an arm snaked round my chest and grabbed hold of me. I thought Charles had come back to finish me off. But then I heard a single word shouted in my ear. Susan! I recognized the voice, the smell, the feel of his chest as he pressed my head against it. It was Andreas, who had impossibly come out of nowhere to rescue me. Can you walk? He shouted. Yes. I could now. With Andreas next to me, I could do anything. I'm going to get you out of here. Wait! There are some pages on the desk. Susan! We're not bloody leaving them! He thought I was mad, but he knew not to argue. He left me for a few seconds, then dragged me out of the room and helped me down the stairs. Tendrils of grey smoke followed us, but the fire was spreading up, not down, and although I could barely see or think with my whole body in pain and blood pouring from the wound in my head, we managed to make it out. Andreas dragged me through the front door and across the road. When I turned round, the second and third floors were already ablaze, and although I could now hear approaching sirens, I knew that nothing of the building would be saved. Andreas, I said, did you get the chapters? I passed out before he could reply. Intensive care. I spent 3 days at the University College Hospital in the Euston Road, which actually didn't feel nearly long enough after what I'd been through. But that's how it is these days, the marvels of modern science and all that. And of course, they need the beds. Andreas stayed with me all the time, and the real intensive care came from him. I had 2 broken ribs, massive bruising, and a linear fracture to the skull. They gave me a CT scan, but fortunately, I wouldn't need surgery. The fire had caused some scarring to my lungs and mucous membranes. I couldn't stop coughing, and hated it. My eyes still hadn't cleared up. This was fairly common after a head injury, but the doctors had warned me that the damage might be more permanent. It turned out that Andreas had come to the office because he was upset about the argument we'd had on Sunday night, and had decided to surprise me with flowers and walk with me to the restaurant. It was a sweet thought, and it saved my life. But that wasn't the question I most wanted to ask. Andreas? It was the first morning after the fire. Andreas was my only visitor, although I'd had a text from my sister Katie, who was on the way down. My throat was hurting, and my voice was little more than a whisper. Why did you see Charles? The week when I was on book tour, you came to the office. Why didn't you tell me? It all came out. Andreas had been chasing a loan for his hotel, the Polydorus, and had flown back to England and gone to a meeting at his bank. They had agreed to the idea in principle, but they needed a guarantor, and that was what had brought him to Charles.
"I wanted to surprise you," he said. "When I realized you were out of the office, I didn't know what to do. I felt guilty, Susan. I couldn't tell you about seeing Charles because I hadn't told you about the hotel, so I asked him to say nothing. I told you about it the very next time I saw you, but I felt bad all the same. I didn't tell Andreas that after I'd spoken to Melissa, I had briefly suspected him of killing Alan. He'd had a perfectly good motive. He was in the country, and at the end of the day, wasn't he the least likely suspect? It really should have been him. Charles had been arrested. Two police officers came to see me on the day I left hospital, and they were nothing like Detective Superintendent Locke, or, for that matter, Raymond Chubb. One was a woman, the other a nice Asian man. They spoke to me for about half an hour, taking notes, but I couldn't talk very much, because my voice was still hoarse. I was drugged and in shock and coughing all the time. They said they would come back for a full statement when I was feeling better. The funny thing is, after all that, I didn't even want to read the missing chapters of Magpie Murders. It wasn't that I'd lost interest in who'd killed Mary Blakiston and her employer, Sir Magnus Pye. It was just that I felt I'd had more than my fair share of clues and murder. And anyway, there was no way I could manage the manuscript. My eyes weren't up to it. It was only after I'd got back to my flat in Crouch End that my curiosity returned. Andreas was still with me. He'd taken a week off school, and I got him to skim through the whole book so that he would know the plot before he read the final chapters out loud. It was appropriate that I should hear them in his voice. They had only been saved, thanks to him. This is how it ended.
Part 7. A Secret Never to be Told. Chapter 1. Atticus Punt took one last walk around Saxby-on-Avon, enjoying the morning sunshine. He had slept well and taken two pills when he woke up. He felt refreshed, and his head was clear. He had arranged to meet Detective Inspector Chubb at the Bath police station in an hour's time, and had left James Fraser to see to the suitcases and to settle the bill while he stretched his legs. He had not been in the village very long, but in a strange way he felt he had come to know it intimately. The church, the castle, the antique shop in the square, the bus shelter, Dingle Dell, and of course Pye Hall. They had always related to each other in various ways, but over the past week they had become fixed points in a landscape of crime. Punt had chosen the title of his magnum opus carefully. There really was a landscape to every criminal investigation, and its consciousness always informed the crime. Saxby could not have looked lovelier. It was still early, and for a moment there was nobody in sight, no cars either, so it was possible to imagine the little community as it might have been a century ago. For a moment, the murder seemed almost irrelevant. After all, what did it matter? People had come and gone. They had fallen in love, they had grown up, and they had died. But the village itself, the grass verges and the hedgerows, the entire backdrop against which the drama had been played, that remained unchanged. Years from now, someone might point out the house where Sir Magnus had been murdered, or the place where his killer had lived, and there might be an oh of curiosity, but nothing more. Wasn't he that man who had his head cut off? Didn't someone else die too? Snatches of conversation that would scatter like leaves in the wind. And yet there had been some changes. The deaths of Mary Blakiston and Sir Magnus Pye had caused a myriad of tiny cracks that had reached out from their respective epicenters and which would take time to heal. Punt noticed the sign in the window of the Whitehead's antique shop. Closed until further notice. He did not know if Johnny Whitehead had been arrested for the theft of the stolen medals, but he doubted that the shop would open again. He walked up to the garage and thought of Robert Blakiston and Joy Sanderling, who wanted only to get married, but who had found themselves up against forces well beyond their comprehension. It saddened him to think of the girl on the day she had come to visit him in London. What was it she had said? "It's not right. It's so unfair." At the time, she could have had no idea of the truth of those words. A movement caught his eye, and he saw Clarissa Pye walking briskly towards the butcher's shop, wearing a rather jaunty three-feathered hat. She did not see him. There was something about the way she carried herself that made him smile. She had benefited from the death of her brother. There could be no denying it. She might never inherit the house, but she had regained control of her own life, which mattered more. Would that have been a reason to kill him? It was curious, really, how one man could make himself the target of so much hostility. He found himself thinking of Arthur Redwing, the artist whose best work had been desecrated, sliced apart, and burned. Arthur might consider himself an amateur. He had never achieved greatness as an artist, but Punt knew all too well the passion that burned in the heart of any creative person, and which could all too easily be subverted and turned into something dangerous. Or what of Dr. Redwing herself? The last time she had spoken of Sir Magnus, she had been unable to disguise her hatred, not just of him, but of all he stood for. She, more than anyone, had known the hurt that he had caused her husband, and Punt knew from past experience that there is no more powerful person in an English village than the doctor, and in certain circumstances, the doctor will also be the most dangerous. He had walked some of the way down the high street, and he could see Dingle Dell stretching out on his left. He could have taken the shortcut through to Pye Hall, but he decided not to. He had no wish to meet with Lady Pye or her new partner. They, of all people, had had the most to gain from the death of Sir Magnus. It was the oldest story in the world. The wife, the lover, the cruel husband, the sudden death. Well, they might think they were free to be together, but Punt was quite certain that it would never work out. There are some relationships that succeed only because they are impossible, that actually need unhappiness to continue. It would not take Francis Pye long to tire of Jack Dartford, as handsome as he undoubtedly was. To all intents and purposes, she now owned Pye Hall. Or was it that Pye Hall owned her? Matthew Blakiston had said it was cursed, and Punt could not disagree. He made a conscious decision and turned back. He did not want to see the place again. He would have liked to have spoken to Brent one more time. It was odd that the role of the groundsman in everything that had happened had never been fully explained. Inspector Chubb had dismissed him almost entirely from the investigation. And yet Brent had been the first to discover Tom Blakiston after he had drowned, as well as the last to see Sir Magnus before he was decapitated. For that matter, it was Brent who claimed to have discovered the body of Mary Blakiston, and it was certainly he who had telephoned Dr. Redwing. Why had Sir Magnus so arbitrarily dismissed him just before his own death? Punt feared that the answer to that question might never be known. He had very little time left to him, in every sense. This morning, he would set out his thoughts on what had occurred in Saxby-on-Avon. By the afternoon, he would be gone. And what of Dingle Dell? The stretch of woodland between the vicarage and Pye Hall seemed to have played a large part in the narrative, but Punt had never considered it, in itself, a motive for murder, if only because the death of Sir Magnus would not necessarily prevent the development going ahead. Even so, people had behaved very foolishly. They had allowed their emotions to run away with them. Punt thought of Diana Weaver, the stolid cleaning lady, who had taken it upon herself to write a poisoned pen letter using her employer's typewriter. As things had turned out, he had been unable to ask her about the envelope, but it didn't matter. He had guessed the answer anyway. He had solved this case, not so much by concrete evidence as by conjecture. in the end, there could only be one way that it would all make sense. He retraced his steps, walking up the high street. He found himself back in the cemetery of St. Botolph's, passing beneath the large elm tree that grew beside the gate. He glanced up at the branches. They were empty. He continued towards the newly dug grave with its temporary wooden cross and plaque. Mary Elizabeth Blakiston, the 5th of April 1887 to the 15th of July 1955. This was where it had all begun. It had been the death of Robert's mother, and the fact that the two of them had argued publicly just a few days before that, which had driven Joy Sanderling to his office in Clerkenwell. Punt knew now that everything that had happened in Saxby-on-Avon had stemmed from that death. He imagined the woman lying beneath him in the cold soil. He had never met her, but he felt he knew her. He remembered the entries she had made in her diary, the poisoned view she had taken of the world around her. He thought of poison. There was a footfall behind him, and he turned to see the Reverend Robin Osborne walking towards him, making his way between the graves. He did not have his bicycle with him. It was strange that on the night of the murder, both he and his wife had been in the vicinity of Pye Hall, the one supposedly looking for the other. The vicar's bicycle had also been heard passing the ferryman during the course of the evening, and Matthew Blakiston had actually seen it parked outside the lodge. Punt was glad to have come across the vicar one last time. There was still a certain matter to be accounted for. "Oh, hello, Mr. Punt," Osborne said. He glanced down at the grave. Nobody had left any flowers. "Have you come here for inspiration?" "No, not at all," Punt replied. "I am leaving the village today. I was merely passing through on my way back to the hotel." "You're leaving? Does that mean you've given up on us?" "No, Mr. Osborne. It means the exact opposite." "You know who killed her?" "Yes, I do. I'm very glad to hear it. I've often thought it must be very hard to rest in peace when your murderer is walking on the ground above you. It offends all the ideas of natural justice. I don't suppose there's anything you can tell me, although I probably shouldn't ask." Punt made no reply. Instead, he changed the subject. "The words that you spoke at the funeral of Mary Blakiston, they were of great interest," he said. "Did you think so? Thank you. You said that she was a great part of the village, that she embraced life here. Would you be surprised to learn that she kept a diary, in which she recorded nothing but the darkest and most unkind observations about the people who lived in Saxby-on-Avon?" "I would be surprised, Mr. Punt." "Yes. I mean, she did have a way of insinuating herself, but I never detected any particular malice in anything she did." "She made an entry about you and Mrs. Osborne. It seems that she visited you on the 14th of July, exactly one day before she died. Do you have any recollection of that?" "I can't say." Osborne was a terrible liar. His hands were writhing, and his entire face was drawn and unnatural. "Of course he saw her, standing in the kitchen. I heard you were having trouble with the wasps. And the pictures, lying face up on the kitchen table. Why were they there? Why hadn't Henrietta put them away?" "She used the word shocking in her diary," Punt went on. "She also said that it was dreadful and asked herself what action she should take. Do you know to what she was referring?" "I have no idea." "Then I will tell you. It very much puzzled me, Mr. Osborne, why your wife should have needed treatment for belladonna poisoning. Dr. Redwood had purchased a vial of physostigmine for that very purpose. She had stepped on a clump of deadly nightshade." "That's right. But the question I asked myself was, why was your wife not wearing shoes?" Yes, you did mention that at the time. And my wife said your wife did not tell me the entire truth. She was not wearing shoes, because she was not wearing anything else either. This is the reason why you were both so reluctant to tell me where you had been on holiday. In the end, you were forced to give me the name of your hotel, Shepley Court in Devon, and it was the matter of one simple telephone call to discover that Shepley Court is well known as a resort for naturists. That is the truth of the matter, is it not, Mr. Osborne? You and your wife are followers of naturism. Osborne swallowed hard. Yes. And Mary Blakiston found evidence of this? She found photographs. Do you have any idea what she intended to do? No. She said nothing. And the next day... He cleared his throat. My wife and I are completely innocent, he said suddenly, the words tumbling out. Naturism is a political and a cultural movement which is also related very much to good health. There's nothing unclean about it, and nothing, I assure you, that would demean or undermine my calling. I could mention that Adam and Eve were unaware that they were naked. It was their natural state, and it was only after they had eaten the apple that they became ashamed. Hen and I travelled in Germany together before the war, and that was where we had our first experience. It appealed to us. We kept it a secret simply because we felt that there were people here who might not understand, who might be offended. And Dingle Dell? It was perfect for us. It gave us freedom, somewhere we could walk together without being seen. I hasten to add, Mr. Punt, that we did nothing wrong. I mean, there was nothing carnal. He had chosen the word carefully. We simply walked in the moonlight. You were there with us. You know what a lovely place it is. And all was well until your wife stepped onto a poisonous plant. All was well until Mary saw the pictures. But you don't think for a minute. You can't think that I harmed her because of it. I know exactly how Mary Blakiston died, Mr. Osborne. You said? You said you're about to leave. In a few hours from now. And this one secret I will take with me. You and your wife have nothing to fear. I will tell no one. Robin Osborne let out a deep breath. Thank you, Mr. Pund. We've been so worried. You have no idea. His eyes brightened. And have you heard? According to the agents in Bath, Lady Pye isn't intending to continue with the development. The Dell is going to be left alone. I am very glad to hear it. You were certainly correct, Mr. Osborne. It is a very beautiful place. Indeed, you have given me an idea. Atticus Punt left the cemetery on his own. He still had 50 minutes until the meeting with Raymond Chubb. And there was one thing he had to do. Chapter 2. It took him a short time to write the letter, sitting with a cup of tea in a quiet corner of the Queen's Arms. Dear James, by the time that you read this, it will all be finished. You will forgive me for not having spoken to you earlier, for not taking you into my confidence, but I am sure that in time you will understand. There are some notes which I have written, and which you will find in my desk. They relate to my condition, and to the decision that I have made. I want it to be understood that the doctor's diagnosis is clear, and for me, there can be no possibility of reprieve. I have no fear of death. I would like to think that my name will be remembered. I have achieved great success in a life that has gone on long enough. You will find that I have left you a small bequest in my will. This is partly to recognize the many years that we have spent together, but it is also my hope that you will be able to complete the work of my book and prepare it for publication. You are now its only guardian, but I am confident that it will be safe in your hands. Otherwise, there are few people who will mourn for me. I leave behind me no dependents. As I prepare to take leave of this world, I feel that I have used my time well, and hope that I will be remembered for the successes that you and I shared together. I would ask you to apologize to my friend, Detective Inspector Chubb. As will become apparent, I have used the physostigmine which I took from Clarissa Pye, and which I should have returned to him. I understand it to be tasteless, and believe it will provide me with an easy passage. But, even so, it was a betrayal of trust, even a small crime, for which I am sorry. Finally, although it surprises me, I would like my ashes to be scattered in the woodland known as Dingle Dell. I do not know why I ask this. You know that I am not of a romantic disposition, but it is the scene of my last case, and seems fitting. It is also a very peaceful place. It seems right. I take leave of you, old friend, with respectful good wishes. I thank you for your loyalty and companionship, and hope that you will consider returning to acting, and that you will enjoy a long and prosperous career. He signed the letter and slid it into an envelope that he sealed and marked Private to Mr. James Fraser. He would not need it for a while, but he was glad that it was done. Finally, he drank his tea and went out to the waiting car. Chapter 3. There were five of them in the office in Bath, framed by two double-height windows, the atmosphere strangely silent and still. Life continued on the other side of the glass, but in here it seemed to be trapped in a moment which had always been inescapable and which had finally arrived. Detective Inspector Raymond Chubb had taken his place behind the desk, even though he had little to say. He was barely more than a witness. But this was his office, his desk, his authority, and he hoped he had made that clear. Atticus Punt was next to him, one hand stretched out on the polished surface, as if it somehow afforded him the right to be here, his rosewood cane resting diagonally against the arm of his chair. James Fraser was tucked away in the corner. Joy Santerling, who had come to London and who had drawn Punt into this in the first place, sat opposite them in a chair which had been carefully positioned, as if she had been called here for a job interview. Robert Blakiston, pale and nervous, sat next to her. They had spoken little since they had arrived. It was Punt who was the focus of attention, and who now began. "Miss Sanderling," he said, "I have invited you here today because you are, in many respects, my client, which is to say I first heard of Sir Magnus Pye and his affairs through you. You came to me not so much because you wanted me to solve a crime, indeed we could not be sure that any crime had been committed, but to ask for my assistance in the matter of your marriage to Robert Blakiston, which you felt to be under threat. It was perhaps wrong of me to refuse to do what you asked, but I hope you will understand that I had personal matters to consider at the time, and my attention was elsewhere. The day after your visit, I read of the death of Sir Magnus, and it was this that changed my mind. Even so, from the moment that I arrived at Saxby-on-Avon, I felt myself to be working not only on your behalf, but also for your fiancée, and that is why it is only right that you should both be invited to hear the fruits of my deliberations. I would like you also to know that I was very saddened that you felt the need to take matters into your own hands and to advertise your private life to the entire village. That cannot have been pleasant for you, and it was my responsibility. I must ask you to forgive me. If you've solved the murder,